There are many thousands of earthworm species around the world with a wide range in size and color and feeding behavior and burrowing behavior and habitat. I'll tell you what, they're all over the place. And earthworms, I tell you what, you can hardly dig into the soil in Wisconsin without hitting an earthworm. And yet they are not native to the Great Lakes region. They were all wiped out after the last glaciation. The current population brought here by early Europeans is slowly changing the face of our native forests. And we hope to be talking about that today with Cindy Hale of Great Lakes Worm Watch and Minnesota Worm Watch. And certainly we hope that you'll join in as well as we visit with her. We're trying to reach her right now. She may have been trying to contact us by phone, and Keisha Mabra is now trying to reach her. It's possible that Keisha, that she was calling us on the guest phone, on the caller phone, so you might check that the next time somebody calls in. We hope to have her with us, and I'm pretty sure, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not sure that we're going to have her after all, but we'll do our best to get her. And just to let you know as well, at 11:45, we'll be talking with Rick Clemmy. Rick is interim dean and director of cooperative extension with the University of Wisconsin Extension, and he will be our guest at 11:45 today. I think Cindy Hale might have been trying to call in on our other line, but apparently we're not able to reach her. So we're going to change gears here and let you call in with your ideas for programs. And programs specifically for this 11 to 12:30 time slot. The number to call, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm really sorry we weren't able to get Cindy here because I was really looking forward to hearing what she has to say. Apparently, in terms of the earthworms, they're changing the pH of the soil in our forest land, and that is having an effect on the tree species. So we're losing, in some parts of the country, we're actually losing the tree species. So, oh, my goodness, we do have her here. All right. We finally found her. So I tell you what, I'm really glad to have her with us, and we will, not, instead of taking calls or questions or questions from you about new programs or suggestions, I should say, we are going to instead visit with Cindy Hale, who is with us by phone. Cindy's with the Great Lakes Worm Watch and Minnesota Worm Watch. She's located at the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and is with us now to talk about earthworms and what effect they're having on us, and also to talk about the Great Lakes Worm Watch and Minnesota Worm Watch as well. Cindy Hale?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Sorry, it was a scary escapade trying to get a hold of me. But our numbers cross paths, but you got me now.
Well, I'm glad to have you now, as a matter of fact. What is what's Great Lakes Worm Watch? What's its goal?
Great Lakes Worm Watch has kind of a two-pronged goal. One is to just get information out to public audiences about this whole exotic earthworm thing, which most people never heard of. You think about earthworms, you ask anybody on the street, are they earthworms, you know, well, yeah, they've always been around, right? And are they good or bad? And, oh, well, they're good because they mix and aerate the soil. And that's kind of a common, it's one of the most common ecological concepts that people in this region have, and what we as researchers have been finding out or rediscovering, I should say, in the last couple of decades is that, in fact, most of the earthworms in the Great Lakes region are not native. They're European in origin. They got here with European settlement. And as they're slowly working their way out from intensely, you know, areas that were settled by Europeans, they're slowly working their way out into more and more native, previously earthworm-free forests, they're having big ecological effects because they're changing the ground rules, no pun intended, of some of those forests.
Well, how do they change the ground rules?
Well, one of the biggest things is they, in a earthworm-free hardwood forest, every fall, of course, you get these tons of litter, literally tons of tree litter that falls down to the forest floor. And in the absence of any earthworm or large detrivore that eats that leaf litter decomposes slowly through the action of fungi and bacteria. And the decomposition rate is slower than the deposition rate, so what you get is a development of this thick, spongy duff layer on the forest floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that duff layer in these hardwood forests is the centerpiece of all the biological action. It's where all the nutrient transformation happens. It's where all the seeds germinate. It's where all of the, most of the root, the feeding roots develop. Larger roots for water and anchoring will go down deeper, but most of the feeder roots are in that layer. And so one of the first things that earthworms do when they invade these forests is they eat that forest floor. And it literally changes the structure and chemistry of the soil and the environment in which all of these plants and animals in this forest have relied upon and adapted to for thousands of years.
So it changes the pH?
It doesn't necessarily change the pH. It changes the rate of nutrient transformation. So, for example, if you take a leaf and you put it out on the ground and it just decomposes through bacteria and fungi, it'll slowly decompose and little bits of nitrogen and phosphorus will slowly kind of leak out as that leaf decomposes. Well, imagine if you fed that leaf to a chicken and then the chicken pooped that leaf out.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a lot more available nutrients, so it comes out a lot faster. And that's basically what earthworms do, is they're eating this forest floor and leaving behind them earthworm cast material, which is, earthworm poop, which is full of these readily available nutrients that plants could take up. The double-edged sword is that when nitrogen and phosphorus, which are the most important nutrients for plants, when they're in the form that plant roots can take it up, they're also in that same form, they're the most leachable. Leachable means that water can wash them away. And so if the plants don't take them up right away, they're vulnerable to being lost. And that's what we're finding is happening, is that when you increase the rate of nutrient turnover, you end up with a net loss because the plants aren't well adapted for rapid uptake. Plant would do really well there, but these native forest plants aren't adapted for the same kind of nutrient patterns.
And where has this been taking place?
It's taking place, well, in fact, it's taking place globally. I mean, these same invasions in northern temperate regions are happening globally. So the same invasions, in fact, the same suite of about 12 species or so of earthworms, they're invading all across North America, northern Asia, northern Europe, New Zealand, Australia. So anywhere that there's been European settlement and colonization, earthworms have just kind of hitchhiked along, probably as much unintentionally as intentionally.
Yeah, I wondered if the Europeans got a coffee can and filled it with dirt and brought them.
Probably some individuals might have, but mostly it's probably through unintentional. Anything that moves soil or anything that moves compost or leaf litter can easily move earthworms, or more importantly, the worm cocoons, the egg cases, which can tolerate drier, hotter conditions than the worms themselves, and they can travel over long distances, and then when the conditions are good, they hatch, and voila, you've got worms. We know that Europeans used soil in ballast for ships and things like that, and so the initial colonization and all the patterns of these exotic earthworms are really strongly related to the duration and intensity of post-European settlement. So the longer and the more intense human settlement has been there, the higher the probability that you're going to have lots of different earthworms and that. And so as you move into more and more rural areas, you start to drop off species until you actually get to relatively worm-free areas, which still exist throughout much of the Great Lakes region. the more remote, the higher the probability that you're still earthworm free. So kind of obviously northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, the UP of Michigan have more earthworm free areas remaining than do, say, the southern areas, which are more intensely colonized.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I, for one, just assumed there were earthworms pretty much everywhere.
Well, sure, and you know what? So did I before I discovered this. I mean, and this is one of the fun and interesting perspectives of this, is that this was as much of a shock to ecologists as anybody, because we grew up with the same kind of common knowledge ecology that everybody else does. We learn this in kindergarten, that worms, and unless it's in your particular field, you know, it's just not on your radar screen.
Cindy Hale, our guest today of the Great Lakes Worm Watch and Minnesota Worm Watch. She's works out of the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth, our guest today. Really great to have her along to talk with us about exotic earthworms and their impacts across our region of the country. If you have a question or comment for her, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call if you're in the Madison area is 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, it's toll-free, and that number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Well, now, these earthworms that we're talking, are these the ones that I put on a hook for my daughter to catch bluegills and such?
Yep, they're your good buddies. Night crawlers, anything you buy at a bait shop is an exotic earthworm. They're most, the night crawler, which is the one that most people are the most familiar with, is a European species. And then another really common bait species, it's sold as beaver tail or leaf worm, is another one. The red wigglers that everybody uses for composting, those are European in origin. And there's 10 or so others. And then what people call angleworms are the kind of lighter grayish-colored worms that you see come up after a rainstorm. Those are European in origin. And there's actually a new species or suite of species from Asia that are starting to colonize the eastern seaboard and have only just begun to move into the Great Lakes, Western Great Lakes region. We're really actually concerned about them because they have extraordinary high metabolism and extremely ability to live at really high densities. So they're used a lot in composting. They're also really super active. I call them kind of the psycho worm. If you see it, you kind of go, ah! Even supposedly experienced researchers will go, ah! Because it acts very non-worm-like. It's very muscular, and so it's used for bait as a result of that as well. But because it has a high metabolism and can live at really high densities, the places that we've seen it invade can even have more dramatic effects than the European species, which is what most of our research revolves around.
We'll take some calls. Cindy Hale, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer on this, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Cindy Hale, our guest, as we talk today about exotic earthworms with her and callers online. So let's go to the phones. Mary in Fond du Lac, your turn. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just tuned in, so I don't know what you've discussed or covered already, but when you talk about earthworms, I consider them very valuable because the farming industry needs them to aerate the soil.
Yeah. Cindy, comment?
Yeah, and that's what I mean by the everybody has this common understanding of earthworms and the really positive role they play in agricultural and garden settings. So everything you've heard about earthworms being valuable because they mix and aerate the soil is absolutely true in agricultural and garden settings. But though the ground rules, for lack of a better term, in those ecosystems are really different than in those of a previously earthworm-free hardwood forest. So you can take that same earthworm that's having really positive effects in your garden and ag system and put it in a native earthworm-free forest, and it can have really different and what we consider negative consequences. So it's not about worms being good or bad. It's just that they have different effects depending on what ecosystem they're in.
How do you find out if you've got earthworms that are in a wooded area?
Great question. I'll answer the question directly, and I'm also going to just send people to the website, which is www.greatlakeswormwatch.org. There's lots of information on how to sample and also identification of earthworms, but the easiest way is just to go root around and see if you can find, you know, on a wet day, root around under rocks and logs, and you'll find out if you have any earthworms of any kind. If you want to do some sampling that's really fun, kids love it, I love it, and it's also very effective from a scientific perspective, is what we call liquid mustard extraction. So literally it's just ground yellow mustard powder, and it's cheapest if you buy it in bulk from your local food co-op. You use about a third of a cup ground yellow mustard powder in a gallon of water, and that's enough to sample or extract earthworms in about a 1 square foot area. So you mix this solution, and then you just pour it slowly over the soil so that it percolates down into the soil. It acts as a skin irritant, just like hot chili peppers burn the inside of your mouth. Mustard irritates the skin of the earthworm. They don't like it, and so they come up to the surface to evade it. And that's how we sample earthworms when we're actually sampling them for scientific purposes. It's very effective at driving earthworms up from deep in the soil and getting night crawlers, which often are very, very deep, up. So it gives you a kind of a better feel for overall what kinds of earthworms you have and what their relative abundance is.
Hmm. Okay, now if you found out that you don't have any, and according to what you're saying, that there's areas you shouldn't have any, how do you keep it that way?
Very good question. Earthworms on their own don't spread very fast. So if you have an established population of earthworms, it'll spread just by, you know, kind of like a, well, it'll just spread on its own, but only at about 5 or 6 yards a year on average. On a really good year, it might move more, but on a poor year, it moves less. But on average, about 5 to 7 yards a year. And so if you do the math, it takes a good 100 years or so to go about a half a mile. So the natural spread of an established population isn't the biggest threat. The biggest threat is through human activity continuing to move earthworms around. And those primary things in the Western Great Lakes region are fishing bait, compost, anything that moves compost, soil, or leaf mulch, or moving the worms directly will contribute to the introduction of new species. So if you can limit those kinds of activities in an area that is still earthworm-free, you can protect it for perhaps hundreds of years before any natural colonization. And one other question I get a lot is, well, I know that there are some worms in my forest, so is it too late to do anything? And my answer, and maybe I'm an optimist, my answer is no, because one thing we do find is that the further you get from intense human activity, you may find one or two species, but you don't get this whole suite of 7 to 10 species. And the more species that are present, the bigger the impacts are. So even in areas that maybe have one or two species of earthworms, if you can do things to limit the further introduction of additional species, you can kind of slow down the impacts, as it were.
Hmm. Mary, thank you very much for calling.
Those are great questions.
Yeah, I want to give some others a chance to join in here. John in Adams, it's your turn next. Hi, John.
Hi, I had a question. You mentioned that the earthworms are eating the detritus and releasing nitrogen. What form of nitrogen are they releasing?
The primary forms that they're releasing are ammonium and nitrate, which are the two forms.
Yes.
The two forms that are most readily absorbed by plant roots, but they're also the most leachable. And
yeah, so you had implications with groundwater contamination?
You know, that's a really good question. We think that there's potential there, but nobody's done that research. That needs to be done. We do think that we know they're being leached. There's some evidence that suggests that the phosphorus is just getting leached deep into the soil and then staying there. But where the nutrient, the nitrogen ultimately ends up, we don't know. So there could be some implications for adjacent wetlands and waterways in areas that are invaded by earthworms, where you might be getting that nutrient nitrogen being leached into the water system. But that research hasn't been done. It still needs to be done.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Wayne in Chicago next. Wayne, hi to you.
Yeah, how are you doing? I love the show. I guess a corollary question I would ask, and I'm not sure if it's been asked prior because I was cut off a bit, but you said the example in the UP and northern Minnesota remote areas is showing the absence of earthworms. Could you talk about the areas where there's a density of earthworms and how the forests are differing as opposed to those more remote areas?
Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure what.
Well, what impact is happening to the forests where there are large densities of earthworms? What's happening to the ecology of that area?
Yeah. What happens when earthworms initially invade is they remove that forest floor, and then the population increases to a point where that they consume all the annual litter input, so you never get any recovery of that forest floor. And that has a really big negative effect on all the understory plants, including tree seedlings. So in a forest where prior to earthworm invasion you might have sugar maple seedling densities of 100 or more per square meter, it might drop as low as 0 or 1 per square meter. Where you might have had 10 or 15 species of understory plants per square meter, you get maybe 1 or 2. So we're seeing really dramatic decreases in the number and the diversity of native plants and tree seedlings in sites that have been heavily invaded and impacted by earthworms. And there is some variability depending on the type of hardwood forest. So when I say hardwood forest, some people will think sugar maple forest. Some people will think oak. Some people will think birch and aspen. And the evidence is showing us that by far the sugar maple basswood-dominated forests seem to be the most heavily impacted by earthworms because they produce the most litter and can support really large, really diverse earthworm populations. In some of the northern, more boreal forests that are more aspen, spruce, fir, they do support earthworm populations, but fewer species and lower abundances. And so we're still not totally sure, but we think the impacts in some of those forests will be less than in some of the richer sugar maple type forests.
Mm. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's good. Could I ask a corollary question?
Sure.
Does that provide implication then that over time that forest could have more conifers and less maples, or you know, what's the directional change?
That's a really good question. We don't know what's the long term trajectory of these forests. If you're down in the Twin Cities area where I spend a lot of time, there's lots and lots of examples of really nice hardwood forests. They've got this beautiful canopy of red oak or sugar maple, and there's no sub-canopy. And in some time, 50 or 100 years, those canopy trees are going to start to fall over and die. What's going to replace them? Because there's no understory. One of the things that's happening in a lot of these forests is that you're getting invasions of exotic plant species like European buckthorn and garlic mustard. What we haven't seen, he suggested, is are we going to see a shift to conifers? We haven't seen that, although it's, you know, the jury's still out. We need to do more research to think about the long-term trajectory of these sites that have been impacted by earthworms and what, if anything, can we do to restore or moderate the impacts. There, once earthworms invade, there's no way that we know of at this point to remove them. And even if we could remove them, it's not a foregone conclusion that the site would go back to the condition it was before, because some of the changes they create in chemistry and microorganisms may never reverse. And so even if we could remove the earthworms, the future trajectory of that forest is changed. And we don't necessarily know yet what that end result is going to be 50 or 100 or 200 years from now.
Mm. Mark in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My question was just partially answered by the previous caller's question. I just want to know if there are any specific sites where you've seen damage from earthworms in, like, a hardwood forest and what's taken over after, like, I guess.
What area are you in again?
I'm in southeast Wisconsin.
Southeast Wisconsin. Well, I hate to sound cocky or anything, but you go to any heavy, any woodlot, fragmented park woodlot that's surrounded by a large metropolitan area, and almost for sure you're going to have a heavily impacted site. There are lots in the Twin Cities area. If somebody actually, and this is kind of an interesting thing, I don't know if I'm addressing your question, but there are still what we call lots of leading edges of earthworm invasion, where you can actually go on a hike that maybe is a quarter mile or so long and go from relatively worm-free conditions to relatively heavily impacted conditions. And one of those sites is in Teteguch State Park along the North Shore. If you walk from Micmac Lake to Mount Trudy, you will go from a heavily impacted area to an earthworm-free area. And it's dramatic, especially in the spring, when you see all the spring flora, all of the trilliums and all of the other spring flora that are absent in the earthworm-impacted area but abundant and lush in the worm-free area.
Thank you very much for calling. So, you know, we've been dealing on this program many times with eliminating buckthorn, and buckthorn has gotten to be a real problem plant for us. And you're saying, I'm thinking, to some extent, we might be blaming the earthworms for that.
Well, we think, and again, we still need to do research. There's some really good anecdotal observations. There's actually a couple of ecologists that I know who have bets out there ranging from a steak dinner to $1,000 that if you can find a site that's been invaded by buckthorn but not been invaded by earthworms, you can get, you know, these perks. We think a few of us at least are pretty convinced that the earthworms come first, and that by changing the dynamics and knocking back the native plant populations, they create conditions that are conducive for the invasion of these exotic plant species. So in some way, they may be facilitating buckthorn invasions. And again, we still need to do that research. We see lots of correlations suggesting this relationship, but we really do need still to do the hard research to document that that's a real causal relationship. But it's sure suggestive at this point.
Adrian in Park Falls, hi to you.
Hello. I'm curious, in areas such as southwest Wisconsin where we didn't have glaciation, are there any native earthworms in that area? And what's happening to, if there are any, what's happened to those populations?
That's a really good question. As far as I know, there's never been any North American native earthworm species documented in the Driftless area. And we think that that's because even though it wasn't covered by ice sheets, it was surely covered in permafrost.
Mm.
And so we think that there probably are no native earthworms in that region. Though, frankly, there's probably been almost no survey work done, so who knows?
Yeah.
And that's another piece of what Great Lakes Worm Watch is all about, is getting people there. We have so little survey data just to help us know the general distribution of these different species. There are over half of the counties in Minnesota alone have no records of earthworms in them. Does that mean there are no earthworms there? No, it just means nobody's ever looked.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
What would woodcock have eaten before the Europeans got in here?
Oh, you guys are great. You ask all the really good questions. Yeah. What did woodcock eat? There are a couple of research papers that I found from the 1930s and the 1950s that looked at woodcock gut contents for feeding studies. And what they found was that these woodcock were eating almost 100% aquatic earthworms or oligochaetes. And there are lots of native aquatic earthworms.
Oh, okay.
So we presume that when the terrestrial earthworms became available, that the woodcock, being smart little birds that they are, moved into those habitats.
So they would have been a more aquatic bird almost.
Yeah, if you look at the historical records of woodcock, their habitat preference or their association was more strongly with these wetland shrub areas where you would find aquatic worms,
okay,
as opposed to the terrestrial worms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, good question. Thanks for calling. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Oh, boy. So many topics to follow up on. Thanks. To follow up on the Driftless area, I grew up in Missouri Ozarks, and are there any or several species of native terrestrial earthworms that, you know, were native to Missouri and Arkansas.
I would presume there are.
And that permafrost didn't kill them.
Yeah, I presume that there are. I know in southern Illinois there are natives, southern Indiana there are natives, so I would presume that in Missouri there would be as well. I am far from an expert on native North American species, but I would presume that there are some in that region.
I mainly called to talk about the future,
mm-hmm.
and that some publications show that the climate of Arkansas is going to migrate to Wisconsin over the next 50 to 100 years as we continue to pollute the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Other studies done actually on websites by the U.S. Forest Service show the species sugar maple will become extinct in the United States. They actually did the calculations of where it's adapted and looked at five different global climate change models.
Mm-hmm.
One climate change model showed one county in northern Vermont would still have sugar maple trees surviving. The other four show they would survive only up in Canada. So my suggestion is wherever there are sugar maple type or forest types that have a large percentage of sugar maples, we should be planting other things, namely black walnuts, pecans, hickories, oaks, shortleaf pine, maybe even loblolly pine. But we need to bring the trees from the Ozarks, perhaps other parts of Dixie, and we may have to bring the native earthworms that those trees have lived with for millions of years since they haven't been covered by ice sheets. So, and that's the other half of that suggestion is we have to take the sugar maples and the basswoods that were adapted to Wisconsin during the 18th and 19th century and find reservations to grow them on up in Ontario and Quebec for the next 100 to 500 years, and that our great-great-great descendants will have to help bring those species back to Wisconsin into earthworm-free habitats when the climate reverts back to what it was 100 to 500 years ago before the humans messed it up so badly.
Those are great. Those are great ideas. I don't know how exactly earthworms fit into that, but they're interesting and thought-provoking suggestions, definitely.
Thanks, Ron, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mark and Kakana, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have a bit of anecdotal evidence, too, and I was curious if your guest today might have some clues or if there's research that might be going on in this area. When you mentioned earlier in the program that the nitrates and the phosphates that are being quickly released due to the earthworm activity would be great for growing corn, I thought to myself, well, corn is just a big grass plant.
Yeah.
And where I go hunting in east central Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, I've been noticing more and more invasions of all types of different grass, whether it's the grass that's Kentucky blue, I would imagine, coming off of people's lawns or whatnot, seed being scattered here and there from the roadside. And I was just wondering if that is, I imagine it's too early in the process that there hasn't been research done, but if you would look at that as being another predictor that there has been earthworm activity and the grasses are, again, taking advantage of the situation. There's a niche there for them now that where there wasn't before.
Yeah. There's a two-part answer to that. In forests, one of the plants that does really well in the wake of earthworm invasion is called Pennsylvania sedge. It's actually not a grass. It's a grass-like species. And it is native, but it does really, really well in the wake of earthworm invasion compared to a lot of the broader leaf kind of herbs. So we do see that in that development of a large carpet of carex or sedges in a forest is an indicator, a visual indicator of an area that's perhaps been heavily invaded by earthworms. And you're right, the research hasn't been done yet on grasslands and how earthworms are affecting grasslands, and particularly native prairies. I've been talking with some folks, and we're hoping to kickstart some survey projects this summer, but there's every reason to suspect that these European earthworms could have negative effects on prairies, but a lot of the tall grass prairies... A lot of the tall grass prairie biome extends well down into areas in Kansas and, Missouri and Nebraska that do have native earthworm populations. Now, those native earthworms have very different feeding and ecology and burrowing behaviors, and so we're not exactly sure how yet what impacts, if any, or what those impacts will look like in grassland areas.
Hmm. Interesting.
Real quick one.
Go ahead, Mark.
At the area that I hunt in southern Brown County is the cover type there is the basswood sugar maple type, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit lower, but it's being invaded aggressively by reed canary grass.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't know if there's any correlation there, but again, that's the cover type that you're saying is most apt to show the effects of the earthworm activity, but I don't know if that's, again, anecdotal that the reed canary is coming in there, or is it that could just because it's a lower type area, but there's very little reproduction, again, in seeds or smaller trees coming up, too, so it's just a bad situation.
Yeah, I haven't done enough research in lowland areas where reed canary grass is prevalent to say for sure, but it sounds like a reasonable or a plausible scenario that, you know, the earthworms invaded. They, again, knocked back the competition of the native plants. They changed the structure and nutrients of the soil and make it more conducive for these exotics to move in. So it's certainly plausible.
Yeah, and it's as I think about all the shows we've done on getting rid of buckthorn and some of these other invasives, to think that earthworms may have had an impact on that in our forest land is kind of depressing.
Yeah, it is. It can be depressing, and you know, I guess I am an optimist at heart. It's like you do what you can and just hope that you never know what the future is going to happen. I mean, one of the good things about the earthworm invasion, again, maybe this is my optimistic perspective, is unlike plant species, they don't move on their own. Plants can, you know, they can be wind dispersed or dispersed by birds, and they can travel hundreds of miles without the help of humans and find new habitats, you know, that kind of thing. Earthworms really are, even though they can spread on their own just by the expansion of an established population, that process is really slow. The primary way they get moved around is through human activity. So we really do have more power when it comes to preventing further earthworm introductions than virtually any other exotic species that I know of.
And again, could you give us your address, a web address again?
Yeah, it's www.GreatLakesWormWatch, all one word, .org.
.org.
O-R-G.
So, and of course, it's www.
Correct.
GreatLakesWormWatch.org. And
correct.
Probably a lot more information on that site and how people might get involved.
Absolutely. And the website is evolving constantly, and we're just getting ready to put up some new data sheets and instructions on how to do your own surveys in your own little forest or woodlot in your community, and then how to report that data so that it can get added to our database. That's a big goal of Great Lakes Worm Watch. It's relatively easy to sample earthworms and identify them at least to ecological group, whether they're litter dwellers or soil dwellers or deep dwellers. And reporting that information back to us, we're creating a database of the distributions of all of these earthworms that has already helped us kind of direct some focus our research. You know, we have limited people and dollars, and
sure.
So we really want to, and unless we have that kind of good distributional information, it's hard to know where to focus those resources. Resource managers, especially, too, on the national forests, state forests, they're really interested in getting this information. So, again, they can focus their policy, you know, are they going to exclude or include ATV use? Are they going to allow live bait versus no live bait? And so this kind of distributional information is going to help all of us in the long run make better decisions.
Cindy, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much.
A real pleasure to talk with you. Maybe we'll have her back and do this again. Cindy Hale of Great Lakes Worm Watch and Minnesota Worm Watch, located in the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. And obviously, she knows a whole lot about earthworms. And it was interesting to talk with her. And I can't wait for the next time I have some folks on to talk about eliminating these invasive species, plant species. I'm going to bring that up with them, too, see what they have to say about it. Coming up, we're going to take a look at cooperative extension in the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension Service with Rick Clemmie, our interim dean of co-op extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.